Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Ham v. AmeriQuest. Mr. Hofeld?
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. Al Hofeld, Jr. for the appellant, Sarah Ham, in the first case, also for the appellee, Shirley Jones, in the second case. May it please the Court. Shirley Jones asked the Court to follow its decision in Handy v. Anchor Mortgage, which also involved the creditor's delivery of more than one type of notice of right to cancel form. Here, as in Handy, the ordinary consumer receiving both the appropriate federal notice of right to cancel and AmeriQuest's one-week cancellation period form could plausibly but incorrectly conclude that the final date to cancel and other TILA protections disclosed on the federal notice are extended to a week. This violates Regulation Z's mandate that the date the federal rescission period expires must be clearly disclosed.
Mr. Hofeld, what are we to make of the representations in the reply brief in the Jones case from AmeriQuest that the notice of cancellation is exactly what you say it should be, namely an extension of everything that TILA gives? That's my understanding, anyway, of what they say in their reply brief.
Your Honor, they admit that their form is merely contractual.
Well, they said that in their in one of the other briefs in this case. I guess that was their appellee brief in the Ham case. But in the reply brief in the Jones case, they say that it's an extension of TILA.
Your Honor, if they're claiming it's a contract, it should certainly be analyzed by the court as a contract. A contract states explicitly the terms of the agreement between the parties. Their form nowhere states that it provides, for example, the TILA protections in 1635B, that they'll provide the damages, statutory damages for failure to rescind or for the underlying TILA violation in the event they dishonor a cancellation. It nowhere says they will pay reasonable attorney's fees if we dishonor a cancellation request.
Well, can I just then say, if I understand your answer to the question I'm asking, it is that because the form doesn't say it's just an extension of the TILA period, then it's not good enough, then it doesn't do that. Because I'm looking, for example, at page 15 in this reply brief in Jones, where they say, this evidence supports AmeriQuest's position that AmeriQuest intended that the one-week cancellation form would extend the TILA three-day rescission period and correspondingly extend borrowers' TILA rights and remedies under the lengthier period. But your position is that it doesn't do it unless it actually says so in so many words?
Your Honor, that is the first part of my position. Another part would be that the Federal Reserve Board advised AmeriQuest that any rights that a consumer would have after the TILA rescission period expires would be a matter of contract between the parties. That is in a letter, a confirming letter that AmeriQuest sent to the Federal Reserve Board in January 2001.
And this letter is in the record?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It is in Record Document 88, pages 235 to 237 of Appendix L to Plaintiff's Additional Statement of Uncontested Material Facts.
Okay.
Further, none of the internal documents relating to the one-week form that AmeriQuest produced in this case, and there was testimony that they produced all of them, none of them indicate any intent or any commitment to provide the statutory protections of 1635, damages for violations, damages for failure to rescind, attorney's fees, federal jurisdiction, none of the benefits and rights and remedies that TILA confers. So their statement, Your Honor, when you look at the record and the evidence and analyze it, is mere rhetoric. It's mere posturing at the 11th hour in their reply brief.
Could I ask also, as I understand it, if somebody exercises the TILA right to rescind within the appropriate three business days, there are prescribed ways in which the borrower is to be made whole. Is that not right? A certain number of days within which payments have to be made and the like?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The federal rescission form that AmeriQuest delivered specified all of the it specified the effects of rescission under TILA, explained those. It also explained the procedural protections of 1635. For example, borrower cancels, creditor has 20 days in which to reflect the fact that the security interest has been terminated, to return any property and money. Then the borrower has an obligation to return any money or property. If the creditor, after 20 days, doesn't accept their tender, then they have the right to keep it, and so on and so forth. All of this is laid out in the federal rescission form. But AmeriQuest form, partly through silence, convinces the ordinary consumer that its protections are no different than the federal form. So, for example, the AmeriQuest form is completely silent about what a rescission would look like by AmeriQuest and whether or not there are any procedural protections. And that silence, together with the fact that AmeriQuest form is on the same subject, which is the right to cancel, and also uses similar language as to the federal notice, leads the ordinary borrower to believe that there's no difference in their rights if they rely on the one-week form and delay any rescission decision past the federal period and into AmeriQuest period.
Mr. Hofeld, would it be your position then that unless there was a total parallel of the TILA rights and an extended period beyond the 3 days, it would fail? It would lead to confusion? Or would you say that it's just a percentage failure in the sense that you could mention some things that TILA gives you in the three-day period and not others? I mean, what line would you ask us to draw?
Your Honor, I submit that it is a complete failure to extend the TILA.
So if you extended it by 6 hours, that would be, you said you had 3.5 days, 12 hours. You would say that would be a misleading thing.
That is correct, Your Honor. The TILA gives 3 days in which to cancel, unless there's another TILA violation, and the right to rescind is extended to 3 years.
Is there any way to extend it? Could they do something that would meet with your side's approval?
I think, Your Honor, they could offer the same benefit of the 1 week time period. But in their form, they could have done at least they could have done two things, or one of two things. They could have either said specifically that in the event we fail to dishonor, a valid request to cancel, we will pay reasonable attorney's fees. If necessary, we will pay statutory damages. We are required to rescind within 20 days, et cetera, et cetera. They could have included the very protections that are not there and which they claim that the form provides. They also, Your Honor, they could have done something else. They could have simply included a disqualifying remark in their form to make it really clear to the ordinary borrower that you are not getting the same protections, you're not getting the same effects of rescission, you are not getting the same procedural protections as your federal form states that you're getting. They didn't do that, Your Honor.
So in other words, they'd be able to say, we're giving you half a loaf, which may be better than no loaf at all for days 4 through 7. But your point is that they didn't say that either.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I'm not so sure that half a loaf is better, because once AmeriQuest has moved people out of the federal rescission period, their form actually makes it difficult to effectuate a cancellation.
But before you go too much further with this, I certainly understand that this is the position that you take on what this is. Judge Kaur looked at all of this and thought that there were disputed issues of material fact on what the likely effect of the additional time might be, and that was the reason he didn't think that that was an appropriate ground for summary judgment. And to be honest, I worried for a little while whether this issue was even properly before us, but in the Jones case, I can certainly see that it would be an alternative ground for your client to prevail, and in the other case, of course, you lost on this ground. So I'm not worried about that anymore, but I do want you to know why the why Judge Kaur wasn't right, why we don't at least have disputed issues of fact that need further exploration.
Sure, Your Honor. To address that question, under Judge Kaur's analysis, the only material fact in dispute was whether or not AmeriQuest form actually extends the TILA protections to a week. In the district court, AmeriQuest represented that its form unconditionally guarantees TILA protections for a week, including, and they mentioned this in their filings below, the rescission procedure of TILA and the attorney's fees provision of TILA. But you can see from the briefs in this court that they're now backtracking and they're acknowledging that their right is merely contractual and that a consumer who files an action in federal court to try to enforce a right of rescission under their form may not succeed. If you read their briefs carefully, you see they talk about how the borrower would have to argue and demand that TILA applies, or and that they expect that TILA applies, or that a federal judge may not see a contract claim or may not see a TILA claim if they have to file suit after AmeriQuest has dishonored under its form. So the other issue, Your Honor, to continue answering your question, with all due respect to Judge Kaur, this court, in Handy and other cases, holds that it is an issue of law whether or not the TILA disclosure has been made clearly and conspicuously. So in Handy, for example, you had the appropriate federal notice of right to cancel and then, you know, a mistake, a wrong form that was also provided.
Mr. Hofel, so it's your position that no matter how minimal it might be, that absolutely no benefit is conferred? Or is your position an ambiguous benefit is conferred by the extension, and that ambiguity, of course, in your position, leads to the result that the consumer is misled?
It is a very ambiguous benefit. One, the dangers of which...
An educated consumer would welcome this.
Your Honor, the ordinary consumer would not know that they're losing rights when they rely on this form. So there's a real detriment here. If a person attempts to cancel and is dishonored by AmeriQuest under its form, all their federal rights are gone. And that makes this form one of the divergent and fraudulent practices that the Supreme Court said TILA was designed to remedy. And under Handy, AmeriQuest form renders the federal form capable of more than one plausible interpretation by the ordinary borrower. And for that reason, as well as the reason I mentioned about Judge Kaur's ruling, we would ask the court to hold that the one-week form violates TILA. Now, if it pleases the court, I'll move briefly to the second issue before sitting down to reserve some rebuttal time. The Supreme Court and this court hold that the official Federal Reserve Board commentary on Regulation Z is dispositive and less demonstrably irrational. Now, although it's called a commentary, it's a regulation. This court has said that the official commentary is part of Regulation Z. In this case, the commentary is crystal clear and unambiguous. It says that the creditor has the choice of either listing all of the payment due dates or of specifying the period of payments. And it says for those creditors who want to specify the period of payments, they have to disclose the frequency or intervals of payments, and this is a direct quote, such as monthly or biweekly. And it goes on to say that a creditor may disclose that payments are, quote, due monthly beginning July 1, 1998. Now, in addition, all of the model forms in the appendix, in Appendix H, use the word monthly in the disclosure of the payment schedule. And if you look carefully at the commentary, you see that the Federal Reserve Board has made a deliberate decision to have it done this way. They say it's necessary. This is the information that's necessary for people to understand their payment schedule. And I'll reserve whatever time I have remaining. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hofel. Mr. Ledsky.
Your Honor, My name is Jonathan Ledsky, and I represent AmeriQuest Mortgage Company, which is the appellee in the first appeal, the HAM appeal. And I represent AmeriQuest Mortgage Securities, Inc., which is the appellant in the second appeal, the Jones appeal. AmeriQuest Mortgage Securities, Inc. is the holder of the Jones loan. AmeriQuest Mortgage Company was the originator of both loans. Perhaps I should tackle what Mr. Hofeld ended with, which is the monthly claim. Our position, Your Honor, is that the word monthly is not required.
So how do you deal with the commentary, since the difficulty with the position that you're taking comes both because the commentary says what it does, and also because one of the reasons that we follow this fairly technical reading of the TILA regime is because of the uniformity requirement. If you start getting too case by case, one is going to lose the benefit of the uniformity of disclosure format that TILA calls for.
Well, Your Honor, I start with this. Hams and Jones counsel sent to you this week the Fennig case, which is a Supreme Court case. And in that case, the Supreme Court says it should ask two questions. One, whether Congress has directly spoken on the issue. And if so, what's it say?
What Congress has done in TILA, it's passed a statute. It has empowered a particular agency, the Federal Reserve Board, to enact implementing regulations. And it's also empowered the Federal Reserve Board to have this commentary. And so you don't have a provision of the statute that says anything about this. You don't have a provision of this. No, you don't. I mean, certainly not 16.
If I may, Your Honor, 1638A lists about five or six different terms, and after each one of those terms, it says using that term. It's an instruction.
That's not the same thing as this, though, because yes, those say using that term, but you are drawing a negative inference from that. That's quite different from what I'm talking about, which is the statute saying it will be sufficient for a creditor to disclose the number of payments, or it shall be sufficient for a creditor to do X or Y. There's nothing like that in this statute.
Your Honor, if I may, the Fennig Court does say that one should interpret the language of TILA looking at the surrounding language of other provisions or sub-provisions.
Fennig Court does not say ignore the Federal Reserve Board's regulations.
It doesn't, Your Honor, but what it does say is one of the statutory principles of interpretation is to try to harmonize the statute with the regulation.
So
and
your
here,
position is that you're going to stand or fall on whether we find this in this statutory language?
Are you waiving any argument?
Are you agreeing that you lose if we get to the regulations?
No, Your Honor. I believe the regulation is discretionary. And I believe it's discretionary for two reasons.
Where do you get discretionary out of the regulation?
Well, Your Honor, because it starts by the word under a general rule. It goes
right,
on to
and
use.
And then the second part talks about the one exception to that rule when you can't tell when the first date is going to
no, but then it's
place.
But then it gives it then it gives th- uses words like for example or may or such as. And I believe that I believe the Federal Reserve Board, if it was going to make a specific requirement to use one word, it would say that in unambiguous language. And I think this is ambiguous language.
It didn't say you can only do one thing. You can either get something. You know, suppose you had a 2-year note, and you wanted to say, you know, here's your payment schedule and here's how much is due on each of these 24, whatever number of dates, you know, 5 dates, 24 dates. You could do that, or you could say once a month or once every 2 months or once a year or once every 2 weeks or whatever you wanted.
Well, our position, Your Honor, is that there is a difference in the statute between certain terms and 1638A.
So that's why I wanted to know,
one
really
has to harmonize the commentary with what Congress is intended in the statute.
Why? So do you think the Federal Reserve Board abused its discretion somehow when it passed that commentary? Do
Your
you think
Honor,
that
if,
should
if,
be
if
disregarded?
You conclude, if you conclude that it's no longer discretionary to use certain terminology but is now mandatory, yes, Your Honor. But I believe
you can harmonize
that commentary with the statute to find that there are multiple ways one can convey the period of payment scheduled. And that the commentary would have used different language if it meant it to be a mandatory as Mr. Hofeld says, using words alone. Nowhere does it say using words alone. And we cited to, Your Honor, the Carmichael decision, which looked at...
Which the Federal Reserve has repudiated, by
yes,
the
Your
way.
Yes, Your Honor, but the Federal Reserve had it said it had to change the language of its provision to make sure that people understood something different. And so our position here, Your Honor, is if the Federal Reserve Board intends something different, they need to change the language of this commentary, because this commentary is not clear. If it was clear, it would start by saying... By not using words like as a general rule, may, such as, for example, nowhere does it say that if a creditor does not list every single payment due, it must insert the word monthly, semi-monthly, or what have you. It doesn't use the word must.
So use the word shall instead, right?
Your Honor, I don't believe it does. It says, for example, a creditor may disclose
well,
the payments are due monthly.
It's in the middle of the sentence, yeah, but I have to find the... The exact language that's in one of these briefs.
It says, as a general rule, creditors that choose this option must disclose the payment intervals or frequency. Our position, Your Honor, is like the Carmichael case. An ordinary consumer looking at the first payment, the last payment due date, and the number of payments in between can understand that 360 payments due in a 360-month period means that payments are due monthly.
But it doesn't say 360 anywhere on your form. I looked at the two forms in the appendix.
Your Honor, it has the first payment due date and the last payment due date.
It doesn't say the number. You say in your brief it says the number 360, and in fact it does
not. Well, it says
not.
359 and 1, Your Honor.
Right.
So I believe an ordinary consumer can calculate that to be 360.
No, you don't know which days they're due, though, do you?
It has the day of the month on each of them.
No, it doesn't list it out quite the way you're saying.
How many of these forms are out there?
I mean, how many loans, Your Honor?
No, is this a typical form that you all have used throughout all of the lending, or is this a unique circumstance here?
It's not a unique circumstance, Your Honor. My understanding is for a period of time, the word monthly had been intended to be added, but wasn't.
It was intended? How did they designate that it was intended? Did somebody just forget, or was it an
error?
Well,
I think there was testimony in the record from Ms. Camacho that this was a programming issue.
What's that mean?
That the form that they had intended that the form would have in it the word monthly, but when the program printed out of their printer, it didn't.
Okay, so the printers goofed it up. Is it corrected now?
It's been changed, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, so
I hesitate to use the word corrected because our position is that it's not necessary.
I know, but it was intended to put monthly in and somebody...
Right, because after all, from a client compliance standpoint, the risk-averse procedure would be to include the word. I'm not disputing that, Your Honor, but I'm saying, given the facts of this case and given the language of the Truth in Lending Act, we believe that the word monthly is not required to be there, but that one must convey the period of payment scheduled to it as an ordinary consumer would understand it. And in this situation, an ordinary consumer would understand the period of payments are due monthly.
Well, my curiosity is how many vulnerable loans like this are out there?
I don't know, Your Honor, because this is an individual case.
When did they change it?
I don't know the answer to that either, Your Honor.
So the change now, Mr. Letsky says the number of monthly payments, is that the change that's...
Yes, Your Honor. It does.
Now, back to the regulation where it says must disclose the payment intervals and then uses examples. You're quite right to say it's not mandatory that it says monthly or biweekly, but it uses a specific example. Would you say that we have an example here, or do we have to, by implication, find the example? In other words, by the division, as Judge Shader said. I mean, we've got to add up the 359 and 360.
Well, Your Honor, I think one does have to add up 359 to 1 to get 360.
Yeah, what I find interesting is, you know, we're talking literally pennies between the final payment and the first 359 payments. Now, I'm not sure I understand why, except for some actuarial calculation at the end. Why wouldn't it be better for your argument if you had 360 payments?
No, Your Honor, because then you wouldn't know what the last payment due date was, and you wouldn't know the extent of the loan. You wouldn't know the duration of the loan. Here, you know the first payment due date and the last payment due date, so you know that it's a 30-year loan with 360 monthly payments, and therefore you can know that with 360 payments due under a 360-month time period, the payments would be due monthly. I would think that would be harder for an ordinary consumer to understand without that last payment due date.
But you are drawing the assumption, I mean, it's not a completely unreasonable assumption, that the ordinary consumer ought to look at this and assume that there's a regular interval for payments. I mean, the language of the commentary appears, among other places, at page 13 on the appellant's opening brief in the Ham case, where it says, you know, one general rule, section 226.18G requires creditors to disclose the timing of payments. And then it says, to meet this requirement, creditors may list all of the payment due dates. They also have the option of specifying the period of payment scheduled to repay the obligation. So reading that sort of reasonably, it seems like it gives you two options, neither of which you did.
Well, Your Honor, I think it gives you more than two options.
But that's not what it says here, though. And that's
what's
where
the third is for a reasonable to disclose in such a way that a reasonable consumer can understand what the period of payment scheduled are.
Well, is there an example of your example of a third option?
Well, Your Honor, I think the third option exists for two reasons. One, because
what is an example of a third option?
I think the one we utilized here, Your Honor, which was to say that there are 360 payments due in a 360-month period. I believe that's an example of a third option where one communicates to an ordinary consumer that what the period of payment scheduled are.
But the problem I have with that is not that it isn't in this particular instance perhaps reasonable, but it's when you get beyond a formulaic type of disclosure, then you get into this, well, maybe this is okay, but then somebody else is going to do something else, and people are looking at all different kinds of disclosures in these forms all of a sudden instead of the uniform type of disclosure that TILA uses.
I think, though, Your Honor, that's the distinction between the different subsections of Section 1638A, which allows for differences in how to disclose what's in subsection 6 as opposed to the other subsections that say specifically using that term. And therefore, in Carmichael, I think correctly the court analyzed the statute and the regulation and found that there was some discretion in how to disclose what was in 1638A6. And here we believe that's the same because it harmonizes the statute and the regulation. If I could turn for a moment to the second issue in this case, Your Honor, I just wanted to follow up on a couple of things Mr. Hofeld said with regard to the one-week cancellation form. First of all, I think the silence of the form is important because as you can see from your questions to Mr. Hofeld and his answers, putting any more language necessary into a form like this just causes problems. That is, and so my client adopted the approach that any modification or tolling agreement, one doesn't contradict what the agreement is that you're modifying. It is adopting all of those provisions, and so.
But you know, on a practical level, I guess what worried me, and I'm still not at all sure about whether there are disputed issues of fact on this, but what worried me about this, I'll take the 20-day period. You know, under your form, if you decided 30 days was a reasonable amount of time to make that initial step, I don't see what in your form would prevent you. And see, in other words, I don't see this as a binary choice, you know, that your company is just not going to live up to what it said it's going to do. And so I'm not worrying about breach so much as the details of the way the TILA process goes forward.
Let me answer that, if I may. And that is, what's interesting, if you look at the notice of right to cancel form, it doesn't discuss timing or all the procedures that
no,
are necessary.
No, of course it doesn't. The TILA form doesn't, but the TILA form's got the statute behind it, whereas yours doesn't.
But our form, Your Honor, references the notice of right to cancel form and says to go look to that. And so my form doesn't repudiate the TILA
But TILA
provisions.
Doesn't make any assurances beyond the 3 business days.
No, Your Honor, that's why my client thought that this form was a good idea and would give people assurances beyond the 3 days. They thought it would.
Why didn't you just put a different date in the TILA form?
Because there are several cases out there, Your Honor, that say that if you put a date other than 3 business days in, that itself is a violation
of
the Truth in Lending
Act. But then there are other cases that say you can put a longer date.
I understand, but then we've got a conflict of law, and it's thought as an invitation for a lawsuit because because you have two varying positions about whether or not inserting a date further away than three business days was permissible under the Act.
So you could have said, as a matter of contract, every single right that somebody has under TILA will also be extended by AmeriQuest for days, you know, for the remainder of the period.
But, Your Honor, I believe my client's internal procedures say that by not distinguishing.
But people don't know that.
But Mr. Hofeld,
there's no contract.
Mr. Hofeld conceded that an ordinary borrower looking at the one-week form believes it is just a mere extension of the notice of right to
cancel. Right, and he's afraid that you're going to pull the rug out from
no. But the traditional truth in lending claim, if I may finish my sentence, the traditional truth in lending claim looks at the four corners of the document. And so if his concern is how we implement this and not the form itself, then to us that's a different kind of claim. That's a Consumer Fraud Act or Deceptive Trade Practices kind of claim. And he needs to find a borrower who suffered a penalty under that and has some kind of proximate cause and injury. Here, it's just a looking at the four corners of the document and how does an ordinary consumer believe their rights or remedies may be altered. And he says, he concedes in the brief, that no, an ordinary consumer looking at the form believes, as AmeriQuest hoped that they would believe, that it was a mere extension of the three-day rescission right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ledsky. Mr. Hofeld.
Thank you, Your Honor. Addressing the last points first, we don't need a borrower who actually suffered harm. TILA does not require actual harm, actual reliance. It doesn't even require that they read the form. This is a TILA claim, not anything else. You just heard them admit that an ordinary borrower would read their form to extend the federal date to cancel, the final date to cancel under federal law announced in the federal form. Under Handy, that is not clear disclosure of the final date to cancel, and that is a TILA violation.
Well, the seventh day isn't an adequate ending point? I mean, you said
that
it has no specific. I thought I understood you just now to say it under Handy we need a date certain, and don't we have that with seven?
Your Honor, the date certain under Handy is the date the federal rescission period expires, so it would be day three. Their form says that it conveys the impression that the borrower's rights are no different under their form than they are under TILA, with the exception of more time. So their form misleadingly and incorrectly under Handy suggests that the final date to cancel under federal law is seven, you know, 4 days after it actually is. And I think my time is up.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.